All right. This afternoon, we need to circle back around to the idea of the transmission of Scripture. Right? Transmission is the process of copying the manuscripts in order to preserve them and ensure they can be distributed and available for future generations. We talked about, a few weeks ago, the scribes of the Old Testament, how they very carefully copied and preserved God's Word. And to some extent, the same process happened with the New Testament, but it was a little different. And to explain the differences, the first thing I want to do is explain how old our manuscripts of the New Testament are and how we're able to know how old our manuscripts of the New Testament are. And so from the original writer until the invention of the printing press in about 1440, everything that was written was literally written. I mean, it had to be handwritten. And these handwritten documents are called manuscripts. And so right off the bat, if you look at that chart on your notes, you'll see that it stops in the 15th century. That's because, you know, the 1400s, right? That's because that's when the printing press was invented. I'm not going to say there were no handwritten manuscripts after that, but there were just not many. And so the original manuscripts written by the hand of, say, Paul or John or Luke, those are called autographs. The originals are called autographs. And we don't have any of the autographs available today. They've either been destroyed or lost or decayed. And if for some reason we did come up with one today, like somebody found a document today, we wouldn't have any way of saying, you know, of proving, oh yeah, that's the original, that's the autograph. We just wouldn't have a means of even doing that now. What we do have are copies and copies of copies, all handwritten. They only vary a little bit in the content of what's in them, but they vary greatly in style, right? A copy, if I was able to show them to you, a copy of John's Gospel from the 2nd century, the hundreds AD, and a copy of John's Gospel from the 9th century, right, sometime in the 800s AD, would look, just looking at them, they wouldn't look like anything similar at all. The content, the writing is basically the same, but like the format of how they look would be entirely different. And so they differ simply because of the materials, the writing instruments, the printing style, and the format have all changed. Now, on the positive side, that helps us date how old different manuscripts are. On your notes, you've got all four of those categories, right, identified, and some helpful, at least I hope they're helpful, little definitions. And I'm really not going to go through all of those in order that they're in your notes. I just want to describe sort of the process of how writing changed over time, and in that process, we'll hit those definitions. So stick with me. I think it will make sense, and it will ultimately be helpful, even if not necessarily today, but for future weeks. This is some basics that are going to be helpful. So originally, manuscripts were in the form of a scroll. Now, there were some kinds of documents that happened before the scrolls. There were pre-scroll documents called polyptychs, which were actually written on little wooden placards that could be tied together and folded, usually three at a time. And they would be good for small amounts of information, like, you know, you could carry a polyptych that had your proof of citizenship or some kind of evidence that you own some property that got changed hands. But they really weren't adequate for even small letters, much less books. But we do see some reference to those probably in Scripture, although we don't see that word. But a polyptych is probably what John the Baptist's father asked for, Zacharias. If you remember the story, he had been struck mute, right? Because he didn't really believe the angel that said he was going to have a son in his old age. And the angel said, you'll call his name John. And so when the child was born, they started to call him something else. And Zacharias was like, something right on, right? And they probably brought him a polyptych, right? Something very small that you could write on. But the vast majority of documents were kept as scrolls. A scroll is simply a rolled up collection of usually papyrus, but sometimes other kinds of paper. And it wasn't like a continual sheet. The sheets were glued together, right? So you would have these sheets that were overlapped and glued together and then rolled up. The paper used in a scroll would have primarily been papyrus, right? You've got an explanation of what papyrus is there. It's a paper made from a grainy stem of a water plant. Now, if you look at your picture, the very top row there, it's kind of hard to see when you're doing black and white stuff, but you can see there's kind of a grain to papyrus, right? There was a definite texture to it because it comes from those grainy plants, right? Long sheets of papyrus glued together and rolled up would have made a scroll. And scrolls were much better than those old polyptychs because it could hold a lot of information. But still, scrolls would only be written on one side, and it wasn't incredibly user-friendly. It would be pretty bulky, as much as, like, if you've seen the movie, somebody pulling out a scroll and doing this, it's just not how it would work. So they were pretty bulky documents. If you were going to carry a scroll of Isaiah, right, it would have been pretty hefty and large. And if you wanted to carry around an entire scrolls of all the Old Testament, you would need a cart and probably a horse to pull it with. Okay, they were that bulky. Now, in the New Testament, everywhere we find the word book is generally actually the word for scroll. It's the word biblos. It's the Greek word that means scroll or a record or a document. And so, for example, in Luke chapter 4, verse 17, Jesus had gone into the synagogue at Nazareth, and it says, "And there was delivered unto him the book," or the scroll, biblos, "of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book," the scroll, "he found where it was written." So you can picture Jesus purposefully manipulating the scroll until he gets the passage he wants. Now, what's interesting, I think it's interesting anyway, this word biblos for scroll is where we've developed our English word Bible from. But the actual word originally was referring to just the format of what was written and not the content of what was written. So, for example, if your great aunt Phoebe put together a collection of family recipes on a scroll, you would call it a biblos. You, much like we would use the word book today, you just need to know, well, what's in that book or what's in that biblos, right? Well, now we use the word Bible to refer to the content without regard to the format. So if I asked you to look something up in the Bible, you could pull out a scroll, you could pull out, the kind of Bibles that we carry. Some of you might look on your phone, right? And all of that counts as a Bible because we're talking about the content and not actually the format. So that's changed. The Apostle John originally wrote his gospel in a scroll. We know this to be the case. John chapter 20, verse 30 says, "And many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this biblos." They're not written in this scroll. And then in verse 25 of chapter 21, John 21, 25, he says, "There are also many things which Jesus did, the which, if they should be written every one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the scrolls that should be written." So, originally, the New Testament would have been written on scrolls, okay? There was another kind of document as well at the time, but it was not very popular. There was a, where papyrus is made from a plant material, parchment or vellum paper was made from dried and treated animal skins. Parchment would have been very durable, but a little bit too stiff to put into a scroll. When you first made it, you could put it into a scroll, but once those things dried out, you'd never get that scroll back open. And so you couldn't really use parchment paper that way. Once it aged, it would be too brittle to bend. And because of this, it wasn't very popular at the time of the New Testament when it was written. But we know that the Apostle Paul actually owned some parchment documents, although we don't know what they are. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 13, Paul says, "The cloak that I left at Troas with Carpus, when you come, bring with you, and the books, the scrolls, but especially the parchments," right? And so Paul had some of those parchment documents. That parchment there is actually a Latin word that got brought over into Greek. He uses the word membrana, which is Latin, even though he's writing in Greek, because it was so not used that I don't even know that there was a Greek word for that kind of parchment paper at the time. So he had to use a Latin word. But later on, that word is going to get used. I don't know exactly when it happened, but somebody finally got this genius idea. They would take the vellum paper, right, which was made of animal skins, and so you stretched a large calf skin or goat skin, lamb skin, and so obviously it would be bigger than this, right? We're talking about something quite large, but I can give you the idea on this. What they did is they took that very thin animal skin paper and they folded it twice. I can't believe I actually practiced this. And then they slit it twice. And what you end up with is four pages, right, that are still sort of connected to each other. And they could take those and they could form them together using wax as a glue, and you could get what's called a codex, right? It's a book, the way we think of books nowadays. Whoever that genius was who thought of it, it really worked out well for him. So those four pages get glued together with other similarly cut and slit four pages, and they are bound into what we think of a book, and the Greek language adopted this Latin word, codex, which describes just a collection of parchment paper that's been put into book form. It would have been a bit more bulky than what we think of as our books today, because the paper was quite a bit thicker, but it was still just a book nonetheless, and it offered some advantages over scrolls, because it could hold more text on less paper, because unlike a scroll, which is only going to get written on one side, you can flip those pages and write on both sides of the animal skin paper in a codex. The animal skins were less grainy than papyrus, and so they were easier to write on. It lasted a lot longer, held up more under use. And there was also the ability to scrape off what was on that vellum paper and reuse the parchment. And so some ancient manuscripts we have of the Bible are found either written over or written under some other document. Those are called palimpsests. I was going to pronounce it wrong. It's not a word you need to know anyway, but look at the style portion of that chart on your notes. The very bottom, on the left-hand side, if you look closely at that, it shows evidence of being a palimpsest, right? You can see other words underneath the words that are on top if you look closely at it. So there were really only a couple of disadvantages for writing on animal skin paper that was assembled into a codex. First off, the one disadvantage is if you happen to be a Jewish Christian, then touching specific dead animal skins could be problematic in regard to the law of Moses. But secondly, this vellum animal skin paper was much more expensive. And because of that, if you look at your chart, it was actually the process of a few hundred years before vellum completely replaced papyrus, and codex format replaced scrolls in the process. Now, let me just get sidetracked for a moment on something that I find to be an amusing twist of wordplay. When you opened a scroll, you had to literally turn the scroll in order to find what you wanted to read, right? Once they had a codex, right, something that's in book form, going through pages, they had to have some word to describe going through pages. And so what do we call going through pages? We still call it turning. So this morning I asked you to turn to 1 John chapter 2, but none of you literally had to turn anything. We're using the old word from a scroll. Now, that in itself is bizarre to me, but what's really bizarre is for the few of you who are looking on your Bible either on a tablet or on a phone, and you're going from verse to verse, what do we call that? We call it scrolling. We've like gone back to the first century to refer to what we're doing on our phones. It's just, that's so weird to me. It's completely irrelevant, but it's weird to me. As the writing material and the format changed, the instrument for writing also changed. The New Testament writers almost certainly all wrote with a reed pen. 3 John, verse 13, John says, I had many things to write, but I will not with ink and pen write unto you. He's going to come in person. But the word that he uses there for pen, when he talks about ink and pen, is the Greek word kalamos, and it's literally a reed, right? Just like you see an end of one in your picture there. Fairly inexpensive because it's made from a plant. You can see how it worked because a reed was a hollow water plant with a stiff stalk. They could just cut it at a sharp angle and produce a point, and the inside, the hollow part, would hold a dab of ink, and it would actually produce a fairly neat, pleasant script. But as the paper changed from papyrus, which was really grainy, to vellum, the writing instrument also changed. A quill pen is just an animal feather. A lot of times it's reinforced down at the base. But it's a lot more delicate than a reed pen. So if you can imagine a quill pen, which is very light and delicate, and you're trying to write on paper, which is super grainy, right, it would be hard to do. And so once papyrus, which was, vellum, which was smoother, replaced papyrus, which was grainy, the instrument that people would write with changed too. And actually a quill pen remained the standard instrument for writing up until the 19th century, right, in the 1800s sometime. And so now we've hit most of those definitions, except the last ones. The first three columns on your notes really deal with like the physical realities of writing. All right, what kind of paper, what kind of pen, you know, what the format's going to be, a scroll or a book. Writing technology changed over time, and so Christians who were copying the New Testament adapted with those changes. But there was another change that was underway that doesn't have to do with any sort of physical reality or technology, and that was just a change in the way that they would write letters. Now, you might think that that's just crazy, but if you've ever gotten involved with the modern debate about whether or not grade school children need to be taught cursive anymore, which I am not giving my opinion because I know better at this point. You know, the very fact that there is that kind of a debate shows there's like this cultural change in the way we're writing. And they went through something very similar. Back in roughly the 9th century, so about the 800s AD, there was a change from writing in uncials to writing in minuscules. Uncial writing, also referred to as majuscules, was the earliest form of handwriting in Greek New Testament. Majuscules are large block letters. There was no punctuation, and there was no space between letters or space between sentences. The best way to describe majuscules is to think of it as being all capital letters. imagine your entire Bible in all capital letters with no spacing or punctuation. I was really tempted to like just print out a page what that would look like to see if I could make Randy's head explode, but I didn't. Minuscules are written in smaller, we think of it as lowercase lettering. The style of minuscules also allows for space between words, thank goodness, and also punctuation and even sometimes paragraph divisions. So in some ways, minuscules were a lot more readable, except that unfortunately, the handwriting at the time as this changed wasn't always as clear. But then that also ends up working in our favor today because in addition to these four categories to determine the age of a manuscript, there's also an entire study known as paleography, which analyzes the handwriting. Just by looking at handwriting, a good paleographer can date a manuscript to between 20 and 80 years of when it was written. So I say all that to say this. While we don't have any of the autographs, right? We don't have any of the originals of the New Testament writers. What we do have is just an incredible amount of manuscript evidence in just about every format you can imagine. You know, we have hundreds, thousands really, of codexes of the New Testament, both in uncials, right, all caps, and in minuscules, the lowercase. We have copies that were written with reed pens and copies with quill pens. We have written on papyrus scrolls or in vellum paper. And by that material and the instrument and the format and the writing style, we have a very good idea of how old each manuscript is when it was copied. Sometimes we also use where it was found or that science of paleography to determine it, but we know about how old they are. So like I said, a copy of John's Gospel from the second century, right, the 100s AD, wouldn't look anything like a copy of John's Gospel from the 9th century, the 800s AD, but the actual text of the Gospel is basically unchanged. Now, go ahead and look at the back of your handout, because you might ask, well, how old is old? And it's generally agreed that the oldest record we have of the New Testament is a document called P52, or Ryland's Library Papyrus number 52. It's often referred to as St. John's Fragment because it contains a little snippet of John's Gospel. And when I say a little snippet, this is not something you're going to stay up late at night reading. Okay, this is that thing that you've got on your notes there, that is the actual size, or as close as I could come to the actual size of P52. It's about the size of a business card or a credit card. Okay, it's a fragment, and the reason it's called a fragment is because it's a little broken piece of a papyrus, and the rest is gone. We don't know where it is. I mean, it's about 2,000 years old, so I don't know how good a shape I would expect it to be in at this point, especially since we know Bibles were copied. The New Testament was copied in order to be read. It wasn't copied in order to be stuck on a shelf somewhere, right? These were read, they were used, and so they degraded over time in the process. This was discovered in Egypt in about 1920. There is some debate about the age, but almost everyone agrees that it dates to the second century, so sometime in the 100s AD, very likely early in the 100s AD, so as early as like 115 to 125 AD, which would actually put it within about 30 to 40 years of the original of John's Gospel when he wrote it. Now, it is printed on both sides. This image you have is the recto. It's what the front side's called. The back side's called the verso. But the other thing you've got there is as best as you can. It's hard to do exactly because of the difference in language. But what's in bold there reflects what's readable on P52. And so by looking at what's bold, you can identify, oh yeah, those are a few verses from John. And you look later on the other side, there's a few more verses from John later on in chapter 18. So What you need to know is, between the papyri and the codexes and the uncials and the minuscules and all of these different formats and different times, this kind of manuscript evidence is just unheard of with any other document in history. Okay? And that's what I'm trying to reflect in this last chart. And so we'll talk about that and I'm going to let you go. The dark blocks on that bar graph on the bottom of your notes are relative to the number of extant, which is another word for existing, the number of extant manuscripts that are known. Although, to be fair, that number is always changing because archaeologists are busy. They're trying to find more. The number goes up. It also actually sometimes goes down, which seems odd, but what happens is that you find a fragment or a partial of a codex and it gets counted, and you find another partial and it gets counted, and then some genius jigsaw puzzle guy shows up later and goes, oh, those fit together. And so the number goes down because those two become one. They actually fit together. But that's pretty rare. If you look at the most recent, I looked for the most recent reliable numbers I could find. This chart is loosely based on a book that was printed in 2019, A Visual Theology Guide to the Bible. It says there are 5,856 manuscripts of the Greek New Testament that are known. We'll use that number, but I actually think in the last couple of years that number has gone over 5,900 at this point. But here's how the chart works. You look at Tacitus, who wrote Annals of Roman History. We only know of his work based on 33 existing manuscripts. It was first written in about 100 AD, so about the time that the New Testament was finished. But the oldest manuscript we have of Tacitus's Annals of Roman History is 850 AD, meaning that from the time it was written to the oldest manuscript we have, there's a gap of 750 years. And we don't know how much it changed in the process of copying over that 750 years. It's hard to find good comparables for the Bible, but that second one, Herodotus of Halicarnassus, wrote the histories of the Greek and Persian War. We know there's just over 100 manuscripts of it. It dates back to about 430 BC, but the oldest manuscript we have isn't until 1300 years later, right? That's a huge gap. So you get how this chart works. I don't have to go through every one of them. I will say, if you decide to read one of these other than the New Testament, I highly recommend Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars. That guy was full of himself. He loved to write about himself in the third person, right? Then Caesar did this genius move, right? I say that because we need to remember that even if we have good evidence of what was originally written, we also have to remember that what was originally written by the New Testament writers was inspired and honest. And what these guys were writing was not inspired, and many times it was clearly not honest. The ancient document that comes closest to the kind of evidence that we have in the New Testament is Homer's Iliad. It's all about the Trojan War. There's about 1,800 manuscripts, which is impressive, but there is still a gap of about 400 years between when it was originally written and what our oldest manuscript is. And you wonder, well, what's happened in that 400 years? It pales in comparison to the number that we have of the New Testament. Documentation of the Greek New Testament includes, like I said, I think at this time over 5,900 manuscripts, some of which are dating back, like P52, to within about 30 or 40 years of when the original was written. And what you'll also see on your notes under that chart is that we're only including the Greek copies of the New Testament. Very early on, in the first few centuries, it was translated into other languages, especially Latin. And we've got about 18,000 more ancient manuscripts of the New Testament that were translated into other languages. That allows us to see if the text has changed over the course of time. Spoiler alert, it hasn't. Okay. We'll talk about that next time, but the takeaway from this afternoon should simply be this. The New Testament scriptures are by far the most attested and well-documented writing of the ancient world, and it's the document that is most able to claim accuracy with confidence to the originals that were written, to the autographs.